How are you feeling in this moment? A little more. I don't want to assume anything. I mean, sometimes I sit on the do my meditation and I just can't wait for the bell to ring, even though I'm leading myself. And then there's other times where I don't want to get up, you know. So it whatever it is, it's all practice, right? And it is what it is, and there's no reason to force it. There's no reason to force it. There's no reason to. We know that there's an intention, a beneficial intention to our practice and to our. If we study the teachings of the Buddha, the Dharma, there's a beneficial outcome, but it can't be forced, and it's not done in extremes. I'm beginning to kind of understand that. Not that I'm able to do it, but beginning to kind of intellectualize, like, okay, I can't force it, which, you know, for me, I'm like, you know, I've changed a little bit in terms of like working hard, but you know, I can start striving for something and getting it. And I think part of that is my conditioning of, you know, being born and growing up in the United States of America, where it's like strive for this goal and, you know, work till you get it. And the Buddha tested all that out for us. And that's kind of what I'm gonna talk about, you know, which is the middle way. What is the middle way, right? How can we trust in that, in the middle way? And you know, when I was asked to speak on this recently, I was like, well, what am I going to talk about with the middle way? What am I going to talk about? And then I said, well, that it's all of the Buddha's teachings, really, when you think about it. If I think about it from that perspective, it's like the middle way is the path of the Buddha's teachings. So we don't go from leaning into extreme this way or extreme that way. And in particular, the Buddha was talking about in extreme indulgence or extreme, you know, asceticism. And he tried them both and said they both, you know, interfere with his goal or intention of enlightenment. And in this article from Tricycle, I pulled out a paragraph that says, the Buddha began his first teaching by telling his listeners to take the middle way, the middle path between extreme asceticism on one hand and sensual indulgence on the other. This exhortation to moderation underlies much of Buddhist thought through the centuries and across traditions. And I thought I had to look up exhortation. And it's like, oh, like emphatically or without a doubt. And when I saw without a doubt, I said, oh, I think that's probably the word that really supports my understanding and what I've heard about the teachings of the Buddha, because there's so much in there that he was so sure that this was the way to enlightenment without a doubt. And he tried both. He tried the asceticism, so where he was starving himself to death and or near death. Thank goodness he didn't die, because I feel like he benefited my life, even though it's 2,600 years ago. I'm benefiting from the teachings to this day, even in this moment, because even sharing the Dharma supports me in my practice, in my understanding of the teachings. I get just a fresh perspective, or either I get more confused and deluded, but either way, it inspires me to continue to practice. And so he is another paragraph that I got. I believe it was also from, I'll find out where it was from. If it wasn't from Tricycle, it might have been from, what's that other one? The other one. The other way. I'll find the citation. But the Buddha's time was a period of great religious upheaval and experimentation. Wandering renunciates from various sects seeking spiritual fulfillment and freedom from the suffering of life became a common sight on the Gangetic path. Before he was known as the Buddha or Awakened One, he was Siddhartha Gautama, a wealthy nobleman living in luxury. But later he left his home, renounced that lifestyle, and embraced the other extreme as an ascetic practicing mortifying austerities. Statues depicting this period of the Buddha's life show an emaciated, he became emancipated, emaciated figure with all of his ribs visible as he sits meditating. It is said he survived on just a few grains of rice a day. Ultimately, the Buddha realized that both indulgence and deprivation were equally useless, even detrimental, to his goal of achieving awakening. And that really spoke to me. My striving is useless. My extreme desire to deny myself certain things in this life is useless. My overindulgence is useless, even when it comes to the practice, even if it's all based on, you know, faith and belief in the Buddha's path. That was not the intention. Again, ultimately, the Buddha realized that both indulgence and deprivation were equally useless, even detrimental to his goal of achieving awakening. Legend says that this moment of awareness occurred the day before his enlightenment. Close to death, the Buddha abandoned his austere practices and the ascetics he had been practicing with. And shortly after that, he encountered a young woman named Sujata, who offered him a meal of rice and milk, restoring his energy. Having found fault with both extremes, the Buddha embraced the middle path in between. In his first sermon, he expounded this middle way, along with the Eightfold Path and its prescriptions for right behavior. And I prefer to use the term wise, for wise behavior. And I understand, I've had some teachers share that writing is like the writing of a boat or something like that, but that's not my area of skill set. So wise to me helps. When I think of right, I think of right and wrong. I either did it right or I did it wrong. I get it right or I get it wrong. You know, it's either right or it's wrong. But wise to me allows me more spaciousness and allows me to have more compassion with myself along the path and in life. Because it's wisdom is something that comes through experience. I don't even think necessarily just age, but with experience, we gain wisdom. And experience on the path of the Buddha, we gain wisdom and we begin to understand or see, have moments of insight when we're like, oh, I'm leaning too far into the da-da-da-da. Or, oh, I'm over here way too much. So how can I tap into the wisdom and stay in the middle? And I think another realization for me is that there's a lot of space in the middle. I don't know for some reason I see it that way. There's a lot of space in the middle. It's not like I have to stay on this 4-inch balance beam like Simone Biles does. Oh my gosh, the incredible gymnast. But there's some spaciousness in there. Between the extremes, and I like space. I need space to grow and explore. I need to feel like I'm free, even as I practice on the path to freedom. I need to feel free along the way, which is one of the reasons I stay with the teachings, because I feel like the teachings aren't demanding that I do something. They're wisdom offerings. They're guidelines for how I want to live my life or to support me in life as I am on the path of living, you know. And just as he said, he expounded on this middle way along with the Eightfold Path and the prescriptions for wise behavior. He tells us how to do it. And that's so important to me. I remember growing up, you know, I'm still growing up, but I remember, you know, growing up when my mother was still caring for me when I was, you know, before I was a young adult. And I would always want it. She'd tell me not to do this or not to do that. And I'd want to know why. And I drove her crazy. Why? And, you know, she's because I said so. That's why, you know, and that had its value, too. I had to listen to my mother and learned a lot of respect. But then sometimes she would give and I'd be like, well, why? You know, I want to go to the high school dance or something. And it was over at 10. And she said, I'm picking you up at 9:30. Why, Mama? Why? Because she knew that some overindulgence was going to be happening at 10 when the party ends. And she finally told me, she finally told me, Ramona, I'm picking you up at 9:30 because stuff tends to happen. That's wisdom she's sharing. At 10 o'clock when the party ends and there's no place else for other people to go. Okay, pick me up at 9:30. You know, and when I'm going to get back to the what the Buddha said, but just as a funny thing, because sometimes she said, I'm picking you up at 9:30 or you just won't go at all. But I needed to know why. So I think that's one reason I'm drawn to the Dhamma, is because the Buddha tells us why. And there's a little more freedom there than what I had with my mom, because he doesn't tell me I have to do it. He lets me know, though, that this way, I mean, he's telling me he's done it. So why am I going to go and starve myself and eat one grain of rice a day and go into asceticism when he's done that? But he doesn't say, do it because I did it. He says, go see for yourself. Ehipasako, which I've done a lot growing up. I've gone to see for myself when I didn't get the answer. And so I have the opportunity to explore asceticism if I want to. And I have the opportunity to overindulge if I want to. And I'll gain my own wisdom. And that's the point of the path, for him to want us to see for ourselves whether those extremes are beneficial and lead to enlightenment, or lead to freedom, or lead to peace, or lead to more ease in this very human life on this planet. Because I always think, if I get to enlightenment, great. It's a byproduct. I feel so many benefits from the everyday Dhamma practice or the everyday teachings when I'm able to tap into them, that, you know, that's good enough for me. That's good enough for me. And so it's so interesting too, because the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path are the fundamentals of the Dhamma, of the Buddhist teachings. And yet again, it's, you know, I'm like, the middle path, the middle way, what will I say? And you go right back down to the fundamentals, right back down to the Four Noble Truths. The truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the end of suffering, and the truth of the path that leads to the end of suffering. And that path is a way that we can gauge our practice in terms of being somewhere in the middle of the extremes. And just for remembering, there is suffering, which we know is dukkha in the Pali. And suffering has a spectrum from, you know, maybe from the rock that got in my shoe as I was walking to some extreme illness I might have, or sickness, or the loss of a loved one, you know, and wanting things to be different than they are. And that the truth is, another truth is that the cause of suffering being greed, hatred, and delusion, wanting to hold on to things that aren't going to last, wanting to get rid of things that I don't have any control of, or being deluded and not seeing. And even sometimes for me, Layla, I'm like, sometimes I can deliberately go into delusion. I don't want to see. I've already seen, but I don't want to see it. And I can delude myself or distract myself and not deal with that. And so those things lead to our suffering, but we can end our suffering by learning to, it says let go, but maybe loosen up or see and be with differently, be with ourselves differently, or be with the situation differently, when we can recognize whether or not it's greed, hatred, or delusion, or any other words or definition that fall, you know, that you can use in place of those three words, to see what's causing our suffering. It's, I don't know about you, but it's not that easy to let go of greed, to let go of hatred, to let go of delusion. And especially when things are rough in the relative world. For example, you know, I won't even go on that tangent, but there, you could probably think of something that's a little difficult to be with right now on this planet. in this life, in our society, and across the globe, really. And so the middle way is the middle path, which is the Eightfold Path. These are, you know, these are things that can support us again in having more peace and ease in our life. And again, not, I look at this as even saying I don't have to even be extreme in my practice with the middle path or the middle way or the Eightfold Path. But these path factors support me in contemplating how to be or how to move or how to act in life that causes the least harm or the least suffering for myself or other beings. The least I can do, the least harm I can cause. And so the first path factor is, you know, right understanding, also seen as right view, like seeing the truth of the way things are, seeing the Dhamma, seeing the universal truth that all things are impermanent. And they arise and they pass away. Seeing nature, seeing the nature of this life, the nature of phenomena, the nature of the cycle of life in general. Understanding what we can control and not control. And then right thought or right resolve or right intention. And again, I like to use the term wise. Wise understanding. Understanding not just these wisdom teachings, because there are many wisdom teachings. I believe these teachings are, or I understand these teachings to be, I don't even say I believe, because in certain belief is like, do you believe me or not? But it's like in my contemplation, I understand this as wise understanding of wise teachings that can be across spiritualities, across, as the other article said on the other side, across to traditions. You know, what is our intention? What are we set off in our life to do while thinking about causing little harm, as little harm as possible? Wise speech. Oh, so interesting. I was trying to remember the eight path factors and I couldn't. I just couldn't do it. You know, I can never remember them all. And the other day when I tried to remember them all, the two I forgot were wise speech and wise action. No, wise speech and wise effort. And I was like, oh, those are two things that I have been in delusion about and knowing I need to practice, but haven't been practicing, especially wise speech. I'm like, I should take that off for like a year. But I know when the wisdom, when the wise speech isn't coming out, when it's leading to more harm. And wise action, you know, how do we, if you think about karma, you could think about your actions, all of our actions that have energy have a reaction. And so how do we want to act in the world, or how do we want to move in the world? Or if we have a choice between this and that or the other, again, it's like, what's going to cause the least harm or the least suffering for myself and other beings? And then wise livelihood. How are we living? How are we supporting and sustaining ourselves in our lives? How are we making our money? People don't talk about money that much in the Dhamma, I notice, but how are we making our money? How are we earning it? Or how are we spending it? And sometimes we don't have a choice because, again, are we causing the least harm possible? Maybe I have to work at a butcher shop to feed my family, yet I don't want to cause harm to animals by promoting selling at a butcher shop or whatever it is I'm doing, for example. You know, maybe I have to pump gas at a gas station to feed my family, but I don't want to support, you know, all that is connected to the industry of gasoline and oil. So do I not take the job and have my family starve? I don't know. But again, I get to contemplate. Because again, remember the extreme. The extreme would be, no, I don't take the job and I'm going to starve and my family's going to be homeless. People are going to get sick. I won't have insurance. I mean, it just spirals on down. So is that another form of asceticism? So how do we stay in the middle with wisdom and compassion? And just being mindful and understanding what we do. And then there's wise effort, the energy we put towards things. How are we spending our energy? That's a huge one for me. How am I spending my energy? And not only how am I spending it, but am I allowing myself to recoup and rest after energy is spent? Or am I pushing again, extreme? Or overdoing, overindulging? And then wise mindfulness, which we do with our stillness practice, or also being aware of aware of every moment in our life, knowing why and how and when we're doing something, being present. And then wise concentration. And lately for me, wise concentration, I like to think about that as collected mind. You know, I think of it because my conditioning, again, of grinding and working hard and striving, I got to concentrate, I got to focus. But I'm beginning to see through other teachers that it's like, it's really a collected mind. When our mind is concentrated and settled and relaxed, do we make decisions that actually are more beneficial than with a stressed, strained, striving mind just to get done, get through? So these path factors, wise understanding, wise thought, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration can support us in walking the path of the middle way, avoiding extremes as much as we can. Yeah. Here's somebody named Melvin McLeod. I don't know, but in terms of the path, the Eightfold Path, he says, by living ethically, practicing meditation, and developing wisdom, we can take exactly the same journey to enlightenment and freedom from suffering that the Buddhas do. We too can wake up. And we can wake up now. We can wake up any moment. In ways of seeing how we want to live this precious life that we have. And how we can live it in a way that is ties in the Brahma Viharas, right? With the equanimity. I really see equanimity as a Brahma Vihara that supports the middle way, because the equanimity upekkha is about being with what is just as it is. Like in the guided meditation, being with our body just as it is, being in this moment of stillness just as it is, with wisdom and compassion. Right? And also the middle way can support us in, you know, being open to all of the joy that we can possibly experience in life. Real joy, pure joy, the kind of joy that, you know, no matter what's happening in your life, that, you know, you could be in the worst situation possible, something terrible but can happen. Like the other day, well, I'll say this. It wasn't so terrible. I was just taking out garbage. I'm taking out my little trash, and I happen to be at Spirit Rock right now. I was taking out my little trash out of my room and walking down to the big dumpsters because I don't like to fill up the staff commons. We have a small garbage can in there with my personal trash, you know. So I was decided to walk it down. Oh, gotta dump the trash. And I hear beep, 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 beep. And I'm like, and then I see a big old turkey, and I'm like, no, that's not the turkey. And I'm like, are they quail? And I look, and it's a whole flock of baby turkeys. And I'm like, oh my gosh, baby turkeys. And so, you know, just taking out the trash. And all of a sudden I see these little baby turkeys, and it just brought me so much joy. Even right now when I'm thinking about them, I saw little fluffy turkey chicks sitting there. They were running and squatting, and some of them were flying around. Others were getting lost, and the poor turkey mother was going, oh, trying to get them around. And, you know, that kind of joy No one, you know, that's real joy to me. That's some pure mudita, you know, and it keeps my heart warm so that I can be open to, you know, some of the other joys in life. Or at least if I was watching the news and I come out and I got to get a break and I could think about those little turkeys. I've been looking for them all day today. They're gone because, again, greed. You know, I want to see them again and again and again. This was yesterday. Those turkeys have, who knows? Who knows if they're even still alive, right? Because the hawks are around. But that moment of joy of staying there. And so, and then the compassion, the karuna, right? Because as we let go and as we become detached, I feel that sometimes the coldness can come up. And that, I don't think that's what the Buddha means. I think that when we let go, we still have to care. And so, you know, along the middle way, these four Brahma Viharas can support us in remembering that the heart is also in tune, part of that balancing act, part of that staying in the middle. Yes, I can let go, but I can still care, you know. As opposed to, yeah, not caring, you know, that whole ignoring thing, because that's a way to not deal too. But can I still care? Can I still care about my own suffering and the suffering of others as I live this life? And then, of course, metta. You know, I've gone the reverse route. I see metta with loving kindness. Can I be benevolent? Can I be kind? Can I really generate kindness and care or just friendliness? You know, even if I can't be friendly, can I just be kind? Can I just be, and sometimes kind can be a big word because I find it's hard to be kind to unkind people at times. And I ask myself why, you know? But I don't have to go so hard. I don't have to go from like, you know, I don't have to love these unkind people the way I might want to love them. But I can still care. I can still wish them ease in their life. You know, there's so many ways that I could describe it or just feel a sense of concern because they too are human beings with the metta, with the heart practice. And even if I can't directly give it to them in the moment, if I just say to all beings, so that I can really know that if I say all beings, then I mean all beings, and I'm not discriminating, even if I can't raise certain names into my mindset at the time. You know, that's good enough. And so the heart, the four Brahma Viharas can support us with practicing the Eightfold Path factors by keeping our hearts open and warm, but also protect it. Because we don't want to cause ourselves suffering either. And they can help us keep this malleable sense of aliveness and care for one another in the midst of all the harm that's out of our control. So I guess in summary, I just feel like, the Buddha did it for us. The Buddha had a life of being a prince and being indulged in every pleasure and good food and the whole thing, legend has it, and protected in the palace gates. And he knew there had to be something else because he wasn't feeling so full there either. Then he left and he saw old age, sickness, and death and was like, oh my God, that's going to happen to me too. Something else got to be happening in this life. Then he decided he ghosted his wife, left his child, went out seeking spiritual awakening and enlightenment. Met with all kinds of teachers. Apparently, some teachers couldn't teach him anymore. He followed the ascetics, almost died, got some nourishment, woke up and said, there's a middle way. I'm not going to share it, but somebody convinced him and he shared it. And thank goodness he did, because it's really helped me understand and continue to get through this life with all of its 10,000 sorrows and 10,000 joys. And I hope that if you continue on the path, if this is your path, whatever your path is, whatever your journey, whatever your practice, I sincerely hope that it brings you peace, ease, and well-being. I think that's really all I have to say. Thank you for listening, and I know there's time left. There's time left. I don't know what. The only other thing I thought about was inviting you to, you know, engage in a little bit of stillness practice and reflect and contemplate on your own in terms of the middle way. Or maybe there's some comments or discussion that can happen before we do that. I hear someone unmiked. I'm not unmiked, unmuted.
Yeah. So Ramon, and perhaps people would like to make some reflections on this. And the one thing that came up for me, and I know I've told this to people here at Sangha before, but Shahar Godfrey was a mentor teacher for me when I was in DPP 6. And I just, this is something that stays with me a lot. And she was sitting here in my house, here in this room, talking to a group of people. And she was talking about, and then this is the time when she was ill. And she was talking about the ultimate reality, like about the dukkha and the not self, and that, you know, things are changing, and all the, and like all the past factors and all of that, and that was a part of her life, and she's just looking, and she knows that, and that was something that was, you know, she really practiced with. And then there was the relative reality of the fact that she was a Black woman, you know, who's like really ill, has cancer, and some of her life circumstances were very difficult, and that the path she took was the path between the two. Mm. That she was walking that path between the two, and that was, and it was like, that was kind of how she was keeping her balance. Yeah. You know what I mean? It was, yeah, just like, so that was her middle way. And I often sometimes think of that as the middle way too. We've, yes, got all the stuff that goes on in our life. And then we know that, you know, somebody says something hurtful. And you know that it's not about you. It's about whatever suffering they have. You know, and all the things, when you can hold both of those, that is another way of looking at it. And I just, you know, what she said that day, I mean, it was like, for me, it was a very profound moment, and is something that I carry with me all the time. Great deal of love and respect for that wonderful woman.
Me too. Thank you for mentioning that and bringing Shahar Godfrey into the, so that she's still teaching, right? And that was a beautiful, to me, a beautiful example of, you know, putting these lists and things and teachings in an everyday way, that another way that we can look at it. So they become alive. They become alive so that, you know, we can see how it really works, like you just said, in the relative world and in the practice. That have, you know, that was, to me, a beautiful share. And that is something else that's important to me, is that, okay, how does it work off the pages and out of the books? You know, I mean, we know it was an oral tradition, but still outside of the list. Thank you for that. Hi. Vita, hi.
How are you?
Good.
I just thought it was interesting on how many issues you connected. You started out with the Buddha's history. You started and how he came to the middle way, and then you went to the four What? The Eightfold Path was something else.
Oh, the Noble Truths or the Brahma Viharas?
The Noble Truth. And then you went to the Bihar, what's the word I'm looking for?
Oh, the Brahma Viharas.
Yeah. So it was just interesting how you somehow managed to hit and connect four very basic teachings. So, what? The lightning tool is what, is that what you said, Bill? Lightning tour. Oh, that's,
oh.
Bill called it the lightning tour.
The
anyway,
lightning
I just
tour.
Found that very interesting how you meant, you just weaved it all together. It was lovely. Thank you.
Thank you, Vita. Thank you. I'm glad it made sense.
Well, I was wondering, actually, at some point I thought it was just all over the place, but it really is all connected. It is what we do, or at least what we try to do.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm just, you know, that's how I see it right now. Like I said earlier too, so, you know, as the practice goes, you hear more, you read more, you practice more. It stays alive, and it's like just seeing those connections, you know, seeing them right now. That's how I see them. Could change tomorrow or tonight. But I think that, you know, like how the Buddha, when my understanding of how the Buddha taught is that all these things or all these suttas are, wasn't meant for everybody, right? He had a way of being able to, if I had the privilege of asking him something, he would give me one sutta, somebody else another sutta, and it might apply to many other people, but I really don't think I have to know every single sutta. But I think some of the fundamental teachings, I'm beginning to see how, oh yeah, and I still got to keep my heart alive, and it's not so much important to me to remember all four of the Brahma Viharas or all eight steps in the path, but to know that I'm keeping my heart connected, causing the least harm. But just kind of, it's huge. It's huge, these teachings. You know, so I'm not, yeah. So I'm glad that I was able to make sense to somebody other than myself. Sarah. Hi, Sarah.
How are you doing? You know,
I'm good. And I got your call. I just have to say it out loud.
I was so happy that you didn't answer right away because I certainly didn't call right away.
Oh.
I want to say I love the weave, whole way that you put the talk together. I loved it. I thought it was a lovely, lovely, lovely presentation of what is huge but holds us, hopefully, on the phone. So I thank you. I love the weave.
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you. Looking forward to connecting.
Oops, let me do this again.
Let me check the time. Yeah, anyone else have any reflections on the middle way or whatever's on your heart? Okay, well, let's do a little more, maybe just a few moments.
I could say something really quickly.
Mm-hmm. Hi. Oh,
hello. First of all, I wanted to say that I didn't go to your talk at Spirit Rock the other night, and I'm bummed now that I didn't because I didn't recognize your name and I just got busy. Or are you speaking this coming Monday, or did you speak last?
No. I actually haven't spoken at Spirit Rock this week. I'm actually here in another role. I'm supporting retreats.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. Okay.
But thank you.
But I wanted to, because your talk was so amazing, and I just wanted to share something about mudita that someone shared with me that I always makes me smile.
Mm-hmm.
That is that, like, mudita means, you know, I think that, I don't know, when I'm in a negative state, I don't want to feel other people's joy. I'm just like, whatever, I'm kind of jealous and, you know, a little resentful. How come I don't have that? But the truth is, and I've learned this now, and now I incorporate it so I don't get that way so much, is just that it's seeing other people joyful and experiencing that sympathetic joy, it means that you can always be happy.
There's so much joy to be had, exactly.
There's so much joy. And I swear that I live that way now. I can see it. I saw today the end of a tennis match where this guy was just so gleeful and he had lost. And he was but so appreciative of the person that he played against and the talent and the wisdom and all that. And like he was just effusing this sense of joy. And I was sitting on my couch grinning from ear to ear because I was like, yes, you're experiencing mudita, even though you lost. And now I am experiencing your mudita. So I'm glad you touched on that. And thank you for the talk.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your authentic joy. You know, I'm smiling because you were smiling because somebody else was happy, you know, and
that's the way it works.
Yeah, it really does. And I always remind myself that, you know, if all the negative energy in the world and negative decisions and terrible things impact me, why wouldn't the kind, joyous, loving things be just as important? Why is it so hard to, I don't know, have those sink in? Why is it so much easier to carry around the heavy load? I don't know. To me, it is. Anyone else have anything? What's the time? All right. Well, let's just be in stillness for a few more minutes. And just allowing whatever's there to be there, and whatever's not there, no need to go looking for something. No right, no wrong. Wise wisdom, compassion, tools and strategies and guides to support us in life. And to see for ourselves, to contemplate. I was reading a book called How Not to Be a Buddhist that my brother bought me. And basically at the end it said, in the end, I'm paraphrasing and not quoting for sure, but in the end of our practice, we eventually let go of everything. The doctrine, the tools, the list. These are just guides to support us to cross the stream. Once we're on the other side, the tools are no longer needed. We've arrived.